My background is literature. I'm looking specifically at women's autobiography, and looking in particular how they write about conflict and resistance. So today, and I look at kind of the different forms that autobiography can take. So I've looked at videos and essays, anthropological work. At the moment, I'm doing quite a lot of work on blogs as kind of an example of autobiography, personal testimony, that sort of thing. So today's talk is going to be about the research I've been doing on the blogs from Egypt. I'm only going to talk about one blog today because I don't have time to go into too much detail, but I've been looking at lots of different ones. And the other thing to say, actually, is my research is focused specifically on cities. So today's talk is very much about Cairo and the revolutions of in 2011 and those kind of protest movements onwards. So I also look at a lot of kind of urban theory in relation to autobiography and, you know, private and public spaces and kind of women's roles within that, which isn't what I'm going to go into so much today, but it gives you a bit of a background. So yeah, I'm going to start with just a little bit of I don't know what people know or are aware of in terms of 2011 and the protests in Cairo, or if anyone's been there, so I'm going to keep it quite kind of general to begin with. Hopefully it's not too boring. And start with a bit about social media and the way it was narrated from kind of Western media, what sort of annoyed me about that. And then go into looking at the one blog I'm focusing on, first looking at the issue of autobiography and then moving on to this idea of solidarity and whether that's gendered, which is, you know, how I hopefully fit in with today's seminar series. Okay, so the wave of protests that swept across the Arab world from late 2010 onwards were interpreted by many commentators, Western media predominantly, but local elite as well, as organised by and reliant on the internet, in particular social media. So it's this idea of a Twitter revolution or Facebook revolution that is reiterated a lot, I think. A typical example of this was the assertion in The Guardian in February 2011 by the foreign affairs correspondent Peter Beaumont that the defining image of the uprisings was not Mohamed Bouazizi's self-immolation in Tunisia, widely accepted as one of the key triggers for the protests across the region, nor was it the celebrations in Cairo's Tahrir Square when Hosni Mubarak finally stepped down. No, I quote, "The defining image is this, a young woman or a young man with a smartphone. The barricades today do not bristle with bayonets and rifles, but with phones." Such narratives, which inevitably set forth a heavily edited version of what happened, nonetheless gained traction because they faithfully corroborated the illusion of a technology-dependent revolution that Western media was keen to promote. An analysis that elided long-standing class distinctions and socio-economic factors, but which tied in so neatly with Western visions of the Arab world, fighting for democracy, one tweet, Facebook update, and blog post at a time. Another major focus for mainstream Western media was the role that women played during the uprisings, an interest that often reverted to tired stereotypes about previously passive women finally finding the courage to speak out. Such evaluations ignored the varied nature of women's participation, not to mention their different ethnic backgrounds, politics and class affiliations, as well as religious backgrounds, in favour of homogenising the category of women. Even articles which disdained common Western stereotypes often ended up making other stereotypes or glossed over difference. The prominent American feminist Naomi Wolf heavily criticised the lack of proper analysis of women's roles during the uprisings. And yet in the same article, she refers interchangeably to Muslim women, Muslim countries, Arab countries, the Muslim world and the Middle East, thus collapsing all terms into one and ignoring the diversity within the region, never mind that Muslim women is not a stable category either. There is also in the same article a final reference to these awakened women fighting for democracy. Such a vision of awakening, with its implication of previous dormancy, undoes Wolf's opening indictment of Western stereotyping. The fact that she neatly categorises this awakening as an echo of the work of Mary Wollstonecraft and educated women in America fighting for the abolition of slavery only serves to unravel her initial criticism entirely. My own current interest in the Egyptian blogosphere is therefore not concerned with bloggers as activists spreading time-sensitive information, but moves away from this prevalent notion to instead focus on them as observers, as well as participants. with long-standing interest in the events that they follow, thus countering the assumption that women in particular only recently became interested in the affairs of their country. The bloggers that I have been examining demonstrate their own forms of agency and are heavily invested in the future of their country, no less so than bloggers whose material is more concerned with day-to-day activism. Today, I will be looking at just one female blogger, Soraya Morayev, who blogs under the name Susie in the City. I'm certainly not positing that her blog is representative of the Egyptian online community, let alone arguing that it is indicative of the broader Egyptian experience. Hers is a predominantly English language blog, inevitably written from a position of relative privilege. But I would argue that Morayev's blog offers insightful personal observations of social protest and resistance culture, observations which I read as both an autobiographical act and as contributing to further understandings of Egypt's recent past. It also raises interesting questions concerning solidarity and whether this is gendered, an important issue to consider in light of the focus placed on women's roles during the protests. So I'll first explore the notion of personal documentation before moving on to consider the issue of solidarity. In 2013, Margot Badran, a historian of women's lives within Muslim societies, published an article entitled Theorising Oral History as Autobiography. Badran, who has used oral histories throughout her long career, collected oral accounts from Egyptian women who participated in the protests of 2011, paying attention to the narratives both as autobiography and as history in the making. Badran argues that the interviews she conducted provide the means for rethinking and extending the category of autobiography, as well as allowing for new understandings of the revolution and of how particular moments unfolded. It is for very similar reasons to those of Badran's in relation to oral history that I am drawn to the practice of blogging. Like her, I am interested in reading personal accounts of resistance as autobiographical acts. For Badran, these acts are engendered by oral testimony. For me, they are produced through blogging. Echoing Badran's assertion that valuable personal stories are embedded in the narrative of revolution, I believe that Morayev's blog insightfully documents momentous events through a personal lens. Morayev's focus is Cairo's flourishing street art scene, which her blog sets out to analyse and reflect on. In particular, she chronicles the explosion of graffiti in Cairo after Hosni Mubarak's fall in early 2011. The graffiti she photographs consistently references the uprisings and the political corruption in Egypt, incorporating popular slogans as well as satirical depictions of the country's villains and portraits of Egyptians' martyrs. Morayev is explicit about the narrative that street art can provide, asserting that, quote, "I like to think that you can read my country's recent history through graffiti, tracing back the chronology of protests, triumphs and failures, deaths and celebrations." End quote. Morayev never hides her own frustrations and remains acutely critical of her country and aware as time passes of how much still needs to change if the revolution's demands are to be realised. Through paying tribute to what Egyptians achieved in early 2011, graffiti offers a sense of hope for Morayev when such demands have still not been met. I quote again. "Some of these pieces have existed since the 18-day revolution, including the murals We Are All Khaled Said and Helwa Ya Baladi, My Beautiful Country." That's We Are All Khaled Said. Khaled Said was... We Are All Khaled Said was a popular slogan that was used throughout the revolution. He's the name of an activist and a kind of commentator on corruption who was murdered by police in Alexandria in 2010. So again, it was seen as one of these trigger points for the revolution a month or so later. So it became a kind of a slogan. Seeing these pieces, these murals, still intact 6 months later gives me a sense of hope that the boundless optimism and almost frightening sense of euphoria of that time isn't just a thing of the past, in light of all the setbacks Egypt has suffered in the past months. End quote. While some street art survives intact, in most cases the graffiti in Cairo is erased, painted over or altered. This makes Soraya's own task of recording this evolving artistic practice that much harder, as well as making digital documentation essential for keeping up with the changes. Evolution is part of the nature of street art, and its adaptation is often in light of political developments in Egypt. That's just another one that I picked out. Through directly responding to events and doing so in such a provocative and visually striking manner, the graffiti of Cairo seems to ingest and reproduce both the energy and the trauma experienced in the city. So again, you've got portraits of people who were injured during the protest. A lot of activists and protesters ended up losing their eyes, I think something like 100 during just 1 month at some point. You see the lion on the... It's a very famous statue near Tahrir Square, kind of similar to Trafalgar Square's lions, for example, and they've put a bandage over his eye as well, which I thought was quite cool. So again, it's sort of charting the developments of the protests. This is near Tahrir Square as well. You've got... The army have blocked off a lot of the streets, basically, to prevent protests. This is quite a long time after 2011. And these are the images on these are constantly changing, with different slogans. So there was a massacre in Port Said, and that has been added on in the right-hand side. And then the left-hand side is, you know, kind of more utopian, hopeful kind of image. This one's my favourite, I think. It's amazing. So it's obviously trying to resist the fact that the street is blockaded by, you know, putting the image back there. I think this only lasted like a week or something before it was painted over, but it's quite an amazing image, I think. Throughout her blog, Marayev charts these visual shifts from moments of celebration to mourning, and thus testifies to Cairo's momentous chain of events. Also present are Marayev's own personal reflections on these events, a particularly poignant example of which is her return to Tahrir Square at the end of 2012, almost 2 years after the initial protests, where the heaviness of the atmosphere, strongly influenced by the new portraits of martyrs, leaves her in tears and uncertain about the future. I quote, Mohammed Mahmoud Street, which is what this image is from, and Tahrir Square have always been museums of memories to many of us over the past 2 years, especially through the graffiti and the beautiful plaques now placed on the street entrance honouring the dead. But today, the street feels like a museum of ghosts, not only of the dead, but of the fighting spirit and the resilient hope for change, and in some sense of me, an Egyptian who felt part of something massive and life-changing and is now left with just faces on a wall. End quote. In this post, both Marayev's honesty and the many photographs she includes of the portraits reveal the personal costs of Egypt's ongoing cycle of protest and violence. Both of these impulses, to speak personally about the events and to share photographs of works that narrate these events, are enabled by the blogosphere, and together I believe that they produce an insightful and at times highly personal account of resistance culture. Inseparable from the online personal testimony that Marayev provides is the intersection with other material and voices which is built into the blogosphere and social media more generally. As indicated earlier, Western media's coverage of the protests greatly emphasised the role that online networking played in instigating protest and sustaining mass action. What I want to consider here is not this dominant debate, but instead to examine the blogosphere as a space where we can trace the narrative of solidarity as it unfolds and changes. In particular, I wish to consider to what extent this solidarity is gendered as a way to explore the issue of women's participation in the protests. The main way in which Marayev explores ideas of solidarity is, of course, through graffiti, often through the numerous profiles and interviews with graffiti artists that she includes, which adds to the sense of dialogue and collaboration that the blogosphere encourages. For Marayev, graffiti is a method of communication, telling important stories and, at its best, able to provide solidarity and encouragement. Quote, "The past 18 months have been psychologically exhausting, to say the least, but street art continues to inspire and motivate Egyptians like myself, not only for the artists' ideas and messages, but also for the resilience and determination that they demonstrate in continuing to enlighten, protest, and educate passers-by with their art." Throughout her posts, she interrogates what graffiti is capable of, how it motivates her, and she acknowledges the impact it has had on her personally. The posts, taken together, also tell a version of Cairo's recent history of protest, both narrating the story as well as encouraging it to continue. Her discussion of graffiti also incorporates the issue of gender. Some of the interviews she conducts are with female artists, and Marayev pays attention to the challenges that they face and the way in which they explore these challenges in their work. She also deals with Western stereotyping of Arab women and clearly asserts a counter-narrative, which both celebrates Egyptian women, but also emphasises that just like their male counterparts, they were guided by a collective sense of injustice in 2011. In a post entitled Women in Graffiti, a tribute to the women of Egypt, she addresses these issues. And I quote, "It's a battle being a woman in an Arab country, but perhaps the dire conditions makes us fighters. Since January 25th, so many foreign reporters have waxed on about the awakening of Arab women in the Arab Spring and how the revolution liberated us, made us wake up, smell the coffee, made us throw off our headscarves and run happily through the meadows. This, in my opinion, is crap. When you look at the videos and photos of the 18 days of Tahrir, you'll see Egyptian women side by side with men in the thick of battles, some even at the front lines, braving tear gas and live bullets. We participated as Egyptians first, not as women. And it's incredibly patronising to assume we became liberated, as if it was a revolution led by men that awakened and inspired us women, and as if women were living in caves and making mud paintings before the revolution." End quote. Mariah's refutation of an Arab awakening reads as a suitable response to Naomi Wolf's assertion of just such an awakening, which I quoted earlier. It is clearly interpretations of women along these lines which chart a course from long-standing passivity to nascent confidence that unsettle Mariah. While she does highlight a change in circumstances for Egyptian women since 2011, it is not the one that Wolf asserts. Quote, "The Arab women I've met are some of the fiercest women in the world, with sincere dedication to their work, cause, and sense of identity. We didn't experience an awakening since the revolution, but we've definitely had to fight harder." End quote. She goes on to note the physical and sexual violence that has been committed against women in Egypt since 2011, and which has made circumstances harder. She reveals that she derives inspiration from the women that she knows, highlighting their strength and perseverance. The sense of admiration that she feels is clearly expressed here in 2013, indicating a development in her allegiances, which require her to emphasise her identity as an Egyptian woman, not just as a citizen, as she did earlier. Mariah's overall narrative does not advocate a particular feminist framework, but she does highlight obstacles that only women face when events impel her to do so, indicating that for her, solidarity works on shifting ground, guided by circumstances and adaptable to them. This sense of a shifting ground and its implication that definitive narratives and fixed allegiances don't exist is a useful notion to conclude with. In a recent review of The Square, a documentary which depicts Egypt's uprisings, Mariah had the following to say about the recent upheavals. "There is no such thing as a comprehensive narrative of the Egyptian revolution. Anyone attempting such a thing will most likely fail, as the complex evolution of a people's uprising to where Egypt is today cannot be summarised in one story." Mariah signals the importance of not allowing any one story to be representative of Egypt's recent history, reminding us that complexity is an inevitable reality of mass protest, something which the rhetoric about social media's dominance and women's awakening does not address. What I hope to have demonstrated through my discussion of Mariah's work is how personal blogs are one component of the complicated narrative of Egypt's uprisings, a narrative that will never be comprehensive, but that can be paid attention to in snapshots. Her blog is one of these snapshots, or rather a series of them, as her posts accumulate over time and her interactions, images and narratives multiply. To examine these snapshots through the lens of autobiography is to move away from the argument that blogs and social media instigated the revolution, and to instead consider how they contribute to telling its story as it continues to unfold. In her assessment of the many new forms of autobiography that she has identified, well-known autobiography critic Gillian Whitlock asserts that when it comes to the genre of autobiography, I quote, "I am, finally, less interested in its ends and its traditions than in its capacity to perform small acts of cultural translation in a time of precarious life." End quote. A similar motivation has drawn me to the Egyptian blogosphere in order to follow their stories and learn from them, both about what autobiography means today and how voicing solidarity is a deeply personal act, iterated differently by everyone.